This is Maggie Jones and Natural Wonders. I'm going to read today, for the second time, but it's been a while, from the wonderful book Those of the Forest by Wallace Grange. A number of people over the years have recommended this book to me in very heartfelt ways. One of them was Paul Brandt, who was the wildlife biologist based in Boscobel. Because I was a wildlife rehabilitator, I got to know him quite well because people would call him with injured birds, and then I would get the call. And I got to know Paul, and the last time I talked to him before he died, he told me about this book and urged me to read it. And I didn't do it at the time. And then my ecologist friend Eric recommended it. He said, "You really ought to read this on your show. It's so good." He wrote me, "If I had kids, I'd read it to them. But instead, I read it to my cat." And they love it for a good reason. It's written by a person who spent countless hours observing wildlife and then writing about them in the most wonderful way. So I'll be reading part of Chapter 5 today. I'm a little overwhelmed at trying to introduce you to Grange. He was a towering figure. I also want to introduce you, if you haven't already discovered, Wisconsin Conservation Hall of Fame. I'll be reading a little bit from their description of Wallace Grange, who was inducted into the Hall of Fame in 1993. I urge you to look at WCHF.org to see all the wonderful inductees. Many of them you will know, and there's a lot of background material about all of them. The Hammerstroms are there. One of the things they include often are letters and correspondence, and often very controversial topics that one person might be arguing with another person you've heard of about an issue of the time. And it takes you back and it makes you realize that nothing was ever straightforward and different positions were strongly held. It's really fun to look up the correspondence and all the back stories about the people honored in the Wisconsin Conservation Hall of Fame. But a little more about Grange from the Wisconsin Conservation Hall of Fame website. He was born in 1906 and died in 1987. At age 22, he was on his way to a lifetime of conservation work. He was named the first superintendent of game for the Wisconsin Conservation Department. He held that position for 2 years, establishing the state's first game farm in Door County. From there, it was off to Washington, D.C. to work on game bird research for the U.S. Biological Survey, which would later become the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. But Wisconsin called, and Grange and his high school sweetheart, Hazel, returned to Wisconsin and the 1,000 acres they had purchased near Babcock. The property was managed as a game farm. I read in some of the background material that I was looking at that this was a desolate, ruined property, very much like Aldo Leopold described, where fires burned through the peat of the central sands and crops failed. Everybody was fleeing this area to try and find better farmland. And so Grange and his wife were able to buy 1,000 acres. Back to the website. There, Grange proved his point that marginal farmland could produce game. The land had been ditched, drained, and abandoned as tax delinquent. Under Grange's leadership, wildlife thrived there as it does today. The state purchased the land in 1962, and it exists today as the Sandhill Wildlife Area, a showplace for conservation programs and a key wildlife area in Wisconsin. Grange is credited with inspiring a generation of wildlife professionals. Perhaps as importantly, he urged hunters to be ecologists. His beloved acres near Babcock were the laboratory for his research. His 1949 book, The Way of Game Abundance, espoused the use of fire and warned against the use of poisons in the environment. He also helped to document population cycles of hares and rough grouse. Grange could also spin a tale for the general audience. His book, Those of the Forest, was a fictionalized account of life in the wild. It can still be found on the shelves of Wisconsin's libraries. So here's a sample of his writing. I hope to read more in the future. This is chapter 5 of Those of the Forest. We're following the life of a snowshoe hare up in central Wisconsin. And spring has arrived. It's the month of April. A drizzle of rain comes, melting toward extinction the remaining snow, where it lies, soggy, compacted into coarse granules of ice, beneath the thickest evergreens deep inside the swamp, in the very center of the jackpine thicket, and in a few fast, shrinking drifts that still project between ridge and swamp. The forest becomes the colors of its dead leaves, sedges, grasses, sticks, tree trunks, mosses, and evergreens. Snowshoe spends most of his hours in the bare part of the forest. The feel of the firm earth beneath his feet comes almost as a new sensation. For many months he has known the resilience of snow. Downridge, the cautiously inflorescent maples show a strong reddish cast in their branches. Yellow-bellied sapsuckers back from the south peck rectangular holes through the bark, drink the sweet sap, and red squirrels follow them, licking up the saccharin juices oozing from the wounds. The gray, fuzzy flower catkins of the aspens burst from their buds, enlarge and droop. The squirrels find these, climbing far out upon the swaying branches to secure them, and rough grouse consume the aspen flowers in quantity. The beavers ram jagged holes through the rotting ice along the shores of their pond, venture from the months-long darkness they have known, and fell an aspen. Snowshoe finds their tree before they have removed all of its branches to their pond, and he too, as well as the beaver, enjoys the flower catkins. Not a dozen feet from a snowbank, upon the warming sands of the south sloping ridge, Snowshoe finds a mass of white-pink blossoms of the trailing arbutus, the season's first display of ground flowers. Juncos and tree sparrows journey in flocks through the woodland, pausing to scratch for seeds among the leaves. Seldom is the sound of their twitterings and whistlings interrupted. The loud, clear songs of fox sparrows ring through the forest. They, like the juncos and tree sparrows, will hurry northward within days. But the song sparrows, their medleys and trills and buzzes almost endlessly varied, are home again to their summer breeding grounds about the beaver pond and in the alders. As the water from snow and rain trickles from the forest and then rushes down the brook, small cakes and sheets of ice pile upon the frozen surface of the beaver pond, in which the main mass of ice is still locked behind the mud and stick dam. Immediately, wherever there is open water, mallards and black ducks appear. They are in pairs, the resplendent green heads and white neck rings of the mallard drakes, the mottled brown and black of the hens greatly in contrast. The hen ducks, as they swim about, utter quick, kittiquit, kittiquit, kittiquit calls of invitation to the drakes. They are eager and ready for nesting, begin to hollow out nests in the surrounding upland at once, line them densely with down, laying a single egg each day, carefully covering the nest with down to protect the eggs from freezing. Whenever pairs separate for a moment in flight, the anxious drakes call with slow and husky concern. Wedge-shaped flocks of Canada geese cleave northward across the sky, honking, gabbling, calling to one another in the little family groups merged within the great flocks. The dark forest landscape lies spread for miles beneath them, dotted by the gleam of ice-locked lakes, which offer them no food, and they fly onward, seeking the shining ribbons of open rivers or the greater waters tossed free of ice by waves, upon which they may drop down to rest and feed. So eager are they to press on that sometimes, where no aquatic food or green grass is available, they must eat the bark and buds of willows. The snow geese streak by in shifting lines and ribbons, even higher above the forest, casting off to float down to the vast continent below the cackling frenzy of their thin and nasal voices, rising, falling, fading, rising again, their undulating goose cry seeming to say north, north, north. As far as the polar sea, perhaps they shall travel. The intense beauty of the tundra in the twinkle of their white, black-tipped wings. The spirit of life indomitable in their voices. Here and there in open water, between floating cakes of ice, the first guttural half-croaks of leopard frogs are sounded. The water has scarcely warmed. In autumn, the frogs went to their hibernation silently, with no songs, yet now they rouse from inactivity, swim and crawl slowly, apparently not yet unlimbered, incipient croaking songs within them. And although their half-croaks seem numb with cold, their voices cannot long be restrained. From where have come their new-found songs before the ice of winter has vanished? Everywhere it appears that the remnant forces of winter are vanquished. Then three brief snowstorms in early April challenge spring, returning the forest to white again, but the tide of sunshine surges too strongly for the whiteness to persist. The fox sparrows and song sparrows sing as exuberantly as before. The flowers of arbutus, maples, and aspens are undaunted. The ice-based drift relics of winter along the side of the ridge and the covering of snow below the spruces continue to contract, their days numbered. Then one day when no chill wind disturbs the shimmering of the first spring haze, Snowshoe hears the tom-tom of the young spring. At the first slow beat of the drum, Snowshoe raises his ears and turns them in the direction from which the drumming seems to come. Thump, thump, thump. The hollow, muffled, mysterious sound ceases. Snowshoe remains motionless for nearly 5 minutes. Then again come the drum beats. Three slow, deliberate, evenly measured beats, followed by a pause, during which the sound seems to hang suspended in the spaces of the forest. Then come the fourth, fifth, sixth beats, the tempo rapidly increasing until the drumming becomes furious and merges into a sustained roll in which beats whir one upon the other in crescendo volume. With indistinguishable rapidity, and suddenly the drumming ceases, poised in the middle of the 10th-11th second, just short of perhaps the 50th beat. Snowshoe, curious about anything new in his haunts, hops cautiously toward the drumming place. Overgrown by alders, a huge and rotten pine log lies prostrate upon the earth and covered with moss. Atop the log and crosswise of it stands the drummer, a cocked ruff grouse. The grouse observes the slight movement of plants made by Snowshoe's approach, turns, and with slow tread and head held high, struts down the length of the log toward the rabbit. Quite suddenly, the grouse spreads his tail fanwise, expands his glossy black-green neck ruff, raises his crest, holds his wings in a shell-like curve away from his body, the lower tips nearly touching the moss and rotted wood of the log, and begins a courting display. He pivots the fan tail sidewise, tilts his ruff, takes a few mincing steps, and straightens up, his head encircled by the rosette of the shining ruff. He shakes his head and ruff vigorously again and again, and the bare erectile red stripes above his eyes become strikingly brilliant. Then, discerning that here is only a rabbit and not a hen grouse, the cock abandons his display, refolds his tail, allows his ruff to settle slowly back into place, sputters, and with sedate, slow steps returns to the exact drumming spot he had left at Snowshoe's intrusion. The grouse turns crosswise of the log, looking all about him. Reassured, he straightens up almost perpendicularly, drops his tail nearly to the moss on the log, thrust his breast forward, and quickly, so quickly it is almost a blur, as Snowshoe watches, he darts his wings out to his sides and as quickly retracts them. A second time the wings dart out, but thus far Snowshoe hears no sound whatever. As the third stroke of the nearly vertical wings tipped outwardly at their upper edges, Snowshoe hears the first sounding of the drum, the first of a group of three slowly measured beats, followed by a pause. The mysterious drum beats seem to hang in the air. Then the wings beat quickly, gather speed, and as the roll of the drum is reached, Snowshoe sees only the grouse's head and tail, and between them nothing but a whirring blur. The throbbing roll of drum beats reverberates throughout the forest. Close at hand, the sound seems surprisingly subdued, particularly as volume appears to increase with distance. Snowshoe's interest in the bizarre spectacle wanes. He hops away a score of rods, jumps upon a log, tucks his feet beneath his belly, and for a time sleeps. Waking, he listens to affirmations of spring expressed throughout his forest. Again and again and again among them, he listens to the drums beating out from all sides and from many hidden logs as one drummer, then another, repeats the singular summons. Heard at this distance, as Snowshoe hears it, and as the drums shall resound thousands of times before the vernal tide has ebbed away, the rolling tom-tom of the grouse is enigmatic, challenging, evocative, compelling. Has it something of the quality of far-distant thunder? Is it more akin to some strange rhythm of a beating heart? How and where and in what long-ago time did the cock-ruff grouse, songless, first give forth this living resonance of sound that reverberates not alone as waves upon the physical air, but also within the very beings of those who hear? As the rolling drums of the ruff grouse throb throughout the forest, the sleeping awake, the torpid arise, the summons of spring is proclaimed anew, and life hurries onward toward summer. The green moss of Snowshoe's log is blotched yellow with trickles of sunlight, and flitting over it, a morning cloak butterfly wings erratically, then flutters down, alighting upon a fresh dung pellet the rabbit has expelled. The butterfly extends its proboscis to the rich chemicals of the pellet, folds and unfolds its wings, slowly, with a flash of gold, purple, and brown. The morning cloak, awakened from hibernation in a cleft of bark, has wings broadly edged with deepest gold, within which is a band of purple, it in turn dotted with spots the color of blue sky, and inwardly to its body are hues of brown, auburn, and umber. As the lepidopteran wings open and close, the undersides are revealed to be the color of dead leaves. When the wings are shut, the glory of color is camouflaged, the imago nearly invisible. First butterfly of spring, the morning cloak, ever a neighbor of Snowshoe, will flutter through the forest until November. Like Snowshoe, the butterfly is fond of aspens and willows, for the morning cloak lays its eggs upon them, and its larvae consume their leaves. Snowshoe, a rounded hump on the log, closes his eyes and sleeps with the surge of April all about him. The first curls of the ferns are just now poking their way up through dead leaves. A single pasque flower, a remarkably situated relict on a dry part of the sand island in the swamp, is in full bloom. The serviceberry buds are swelling, nearly ready to burst white blossoms upon their leafless branches. The white-throated sparrows are back to their sphagnum moss retreats, whistling loud, clear songs. Myrtle warblers, rusty blackbirds, kinglets, grackles, swamp sparrows, kingfishers, a vast host of avian neighbors have returned to swamp, pond, and ridge. Melodies are everywhere. Swirling above Snowshoe is a swarm of minute insects, midges, circling, turning, circling, swirling, giving forth the faintest of hummings, the cloud of them like dancing atoms. Each swings about an orbit, and their many orbits seem somehow related, yet the swirling insects never appear to collide. The forest has heard no hum of insects throughout the long, long winter, and now the sound is here again, and the swinging cloud hangs as if anchored to the space above Snowshoe, and from what secret place the insects have come, their humming does not reveal. Perhaps all these events mark the last of winter, the first moments of the real spring? Or was there ever a winter at all? Were there howling blizzards, unceasing snows, bitter cold, a time of hunger? As Snowshoe half sleeps, half wakes to all the sights and sounds about him, he feels deeply the great transformation of the world, feels the new freedom in the unfettered forest. He himself is rapidly becoming a spring rabbit, a brown one, casting off the habiliments of the white winter. The faint purling sound of water tumbling over the beaver dam is borne upon the crisp air. The snow water hurries onward, perhaps reluctant not to tarry longer, with the rising chorus of voices, which, if they could stay the march of seasons, would clasp April to them forever. When earth becomes mellow, life bursts forth anew, for the struggle of winter or the time of dormant repose is past. When all things are touched by warmth and rise up to new lives or lay aside old ones. And I'll stop there. Reading from Chapter 5 of Those of the Forest by Wallace Grange. It was first published in 1953. This is Maggie Jones and Natural Wonders. Thank you for listening.